This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Raising kids here has been surprisingly, delightful. So
really?
Yeah. There's so much great culture for them. And we're always going to the museums, and there's so many great nature parts and nature parts.
Nature parts. We got some nature parts too.
Yeah, you know, the nature parts.
I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter.
And I'm a writer,
but... Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. Today we have Erica Krause, who is the author of Come Up and See Me Sometime, a New York Times notable book, and Contenders, a finalist for the VCU Cable First Novelist Award. Erica's fiction has been published in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Plowshares, One Story, and more. She teaches creative writing at the Lighthouse Writers Workshop and lives in Colorado. Her debut memoir, Tell Me Everything, has been optioned for TV adaptation by Playground Entertainment. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
We are so excited. I was nervous, sitting here waiting for this to start, because I feel kind of starstruck.
Yes. This is as excited as I've been for an episode. Truly.
I love this book.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Absolutely. That's so kind of you.
Yeah. Oh, my hands were shaking and everything. So I'm excited to throw it over to you so I can vibrate in silence while you read to us.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. Okay. Now I'm nervous. Okay. So I'm going to read from the beginning of the book, and it's the first chapter, and it's the chapter's called The Face. I became a private investigator because of my face. It's an ordinary looking face, but if I ask, how are you? Sometimes people start crying. I'm getting a divorce, they say. He ended our marriage by text. Or, I was just diagnosed with late-stage Lyme disease. Or a man grips a packet of peas in the frozen food aisle and asks, how do you cook these? My wife died last month. Or an immaculately dressed woman suddenly tells me, I hate my job so much I want to kill myself. I've been saving up Ambiens. Then we sit on a concrete curb or stand in line at a train station or clutch clear plastic cups at a party as the near stranger in front of me dabs away mascara with a cocktail napkin and dumps out her mind like it's her purse, like I'm the one who can sift through the dust and use tissues to find what she's looking for. Demographics don't seem to matter. Young, old, women, men, non-binary, gay, straight, rich, poor, east, west, everyone tells me things. A woman with 26 grandchildren and 15 great-grandchildren whispered to me on her 101st birthday party that she wished she'd never had kids, that she had wasted her life on all these people. After I volunteered at an elementary school, a 6-year-old followed me all the way to the bathroom to tell me in Spanish that her daddy's not going to come home anymore. Even as a kid, I was a storage locker for people's secrets. Grown-ups confessed their affairs, lost fetuses, traumas. When I was 7, my maternal grandmother told me her husband chased her with a knife. When one of my elementary school teachers told me he was leaving his wife because she hoarded pizza boxes and dead bugs. When I was 14, my mother's friend yucked me aside and said, I just want to say your mother's a bitch. You know she's a bitch, right? When I was 17, X, my abuser, blurted out that he had denied a promotion to a friend at work because he was black. This wasn't intimacy. We hated each other. I thought that was just how other people were, confessing things all the time, that everyone experienced these constant revelations from both kin and strangers. Except people would always say, I don't know why I'm telling you this, or I've never told this to anyone before. Nobody told my older sister or younger brother these things, even though we look similar, so it must be me, something I was doing, right or wrong or neither. Something in my face bore the shape of a key or a steel table on which to lay something heavy. Where do I know you from? Strangers asked brightly. One surreal morning on a springtime park bench, 3 strangers in a row insisted they knew me as each sat down in turn. Do you work at the library? Do you know Pat? Do you eat at Dots? I said, no, I just have a familiar face. This happens to me all the time. One woman said, with that face, you must have a tough time even going outside without people bugging you. Does a familiar face imply a forgettable one? One ex-boyfriend forgot my name. This is, he said, actually snapping his fingers, trying to introduce me to his new girlfriend. Another ex-boyfriend remembered my name, but forgot we had been together for a year. What's it like to date you, I wonder, he flirted over the phone, until I reminded him we did not date not long ago, and he had sort of kind of proposed to me amid a watch of emotion that he felt after a screening of Moulin Rouge. But how could I get mad at him? Nobody remembers a mirror. When I was 13, my family moved to Japan for 4 years. The first year, nobody seemed to understand anything I said. No, no, they said, waving their hands in front of their faces. No speak English. But I'm speaking in Japanese, I said in Japanese, and they stared blankly at my casual body, my oddness. At some point, without realizing it, my gestures morphed from American to Japanese ones. I covered my teeth when I smiled, nodded in short bows, kept my fingers pressed tightly together, pinned my elbows to my sides. My Japanese hadn't improved much, but people now called me fluent, peta peta. They would talk and talk and talk to me, way beyond my capacity to comprehend the language. They insisted I was half Japanese, hafu desu. My mimicry was getting me adopted. Keep your friends close, but keep your enemies closer, even if you have to become just like them. As a child, whenever I had to take car trips with X, it was safer to sit directly behind him, because he couldn't hit me without having to pull over and haul me out. Sitting there, I felt like his lesser shadow. I couldn't read a book because it made me carsick, so I spent the time memorizing the back of the head I hated most. If the car came to a sudden stop, I pitched forward until I could smell the dead skin stench of his hair, terrified I might somehow merge right into his body. Imitation isn't flattery, it's protection. There's a class of animals called mimics who pretend to be other kinds of animals to avoid becoming the delicious prey they indeed are. The powdery gray owl butterfly bears a convincing owl eye spot on each wing, guarding it from bird attack. The harmless milk snake imitates venomous copperheads and coral snakes with bright red-orange bands to ward off predators. Their lives are their hides. Tear a mimic free from her disguise, and you'll find only inner flesh, viscera, a heart emptying its last blood into the dirt. She will die and be eaten. Unless she learns how to rip off your disguise first.
Erica, I'm so glad you read the opening for us, because as soon as I read the opening page of this book, I knew two things. I knew that you wrote fiction, even though I was not familiar with your work, because it just had that incredible clarity and snap to the sentences that there was just no way you weren't a fiction writer. And the other thing was I was just stunned at, when I finished the book, how you decided to open there, because you're in the world of the book so immediately, and you have woven several of the threads that are going to continue throughout the book right away. But there's also a kind of, I was just stunned by the opening, to be honest. And I wanted to know if that's something that you had as an entry point early in drafting, or if you found your way into this book, this opening later on.
That's an interesting question, because as a fiction writer, you know that the entry into a book is the character, right? And it's really hard to think of yourself as a character, especially when you spend your life not thinking of yourself as really anything, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But I knew that I had to establish kind of a right to tell this story, because it's a really intense story that involves people who are not me, who involves a historic lawsuit that I wasn't the lawyer, I wasn't the plaintiff, I was just a person working on it, right? So I had to sort of show why me for that story. And the reason why me is that I did this particular job interfacing with people and getting them to trust me and getting them to talk to me about their worst day, really. And the way I would do that wasn't just the way I would learn about them was through their face. You know what I mean? That's how you meet each other, right? You look at each other's faces and you sort of learn a little bit from their expressions, et cetera. But I thought, okay, if I'm going to establish myself, I really do have to talk about my own face, right? Mm-hmm. And the face that people are going to see from then on in every single interaction, and that will make them decide to trust me with their stories or not.
When, at what point did you know, okay, I have a book here and I want to write this book?
Oh my gosh, I came to this so reluctantly. You wouldn't even believe. First, I was never, ever, never going to write a memoir. That was one of those, like, I'll write anything, but not a memoir.
Wow.
I didn't think I had enough to say, honestly. And then, and this story also never really felt like mine to start with, mm-hmm. because again, I was an investigator, but I wasn't, say, the lead attorney, and I wasn't any of the plaintiffs. I wasn't even one of the major witnesses. So I was just the person who dug around. So I really did not think this was going to be a story for me. But what ended up happening, this story actually came out of rejection letters. So I submitted to, the magazine Granta.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that pie in the sky. You want to publish there, mm-hmm. right? so I submitted stories in three genres to them. I mean, like over 20 years, and they always said no. But over time, the person who was saying no to me became a specific person, like he's like sending me directly, but he was like a reader, and then he got promoted, right? So it was kind of, I had this person again, still getting the rejections. And I had, on one rejection, he said, still no, still kind of hate what you sent me, but, I mean, he was nicer than that, but he said, I've seen from your cover letter, which I've read 400 times, that you were a private investigator. Would you like to, write something on spec for our mental states issue? And I said, absolutely. And he said, give me 3,000 words. I gave him 6. Mm. And it was this, basically the keystone essay for the book. And it was about the character that in the book is called Daisy, who's a sex worker who provided sex workers for the recruits in the case. So it was about her. And then as I was writing it, I was like, oh my God, I'm leaving everything out. I feel like I'm writing this story, but as much as I'm writing, I feel like I'm not writing. And it felt just so much bigger. And since I never even considered writing about this case, it almost was like there was this flood of, or this, it's like this pressure back, pushing against me and mm-hmm. telling me, say more. And so after I published that essay, which was, was a career high, right, to publish there, I just knew it was a bigger story. I mean, just from the amount that I couldn't say in that short of a space. So I talked to my agent and I said, what do you think? And she said, okay, buckle up, let's try.
I would think she'd be like, oh, fuck yes.
Exactly. Well, she was very supportive. Maybe I was the one who was like, oh no. I don't know if I want to think about this for, 2 years or whatever. but yeah, she was behind the project from the beginning. And if she had even been a little bit like, I don't know, I don't think we should do it, I would have been like, sure, okay, great, we won't do it, forget it, it's forgotten.
Been like,
it's
not, thank God.
I know. Some projects like push you, right?
There are some constraints in this book, Erica, that mm-hmm. obviously have to do with some of the, the fact that there was a massive lawsuit at the heart of this book, and right. there are survivors of horrific abuse. Mm-hmm. There are a number of names that are not given in the book, right. and also, a large public university that is easily found out but not named in the book. I was curious yeah. how early on those constraints or just decision to especially with the more public names, I'm not referring to the victims of the abuse, but
right.
things like that, did you know very early on that naming names in that sense was not going to be a facet of the project?
Yeah, I mean, I thought about that maybe more than anything, really any other single topic. So when I was a PI, the way I would find people was through, if I just had one name, and one name would give me at least 5 more, because that's how we know about each other, is through association with other people, right? Mm-hmm. So I knew if I could find a lot of people from one name that I really better not be supplying those names. You know what I mean? Mm. Because there's a big difference between me sort of dishing it all out on a plate and here are all the names of all the people in this very public lawsuit, and also someone reading a 300-page book and then going on the internet and searching around and finding for themselves, you know. So I felt like I wanted to protect the identities of the people who really wanted privacy, justifiably, and deserved privacy. And that's why I made a weird choice to not even name, you know, the perpetrators or the university, right? So I was sort mm-hmm. of going to these extremes. The thing that gave me more trouble was deciding not to name my own abuser, because at first I was like, well, then I'm just like, it felt like being an apologist or something for what he did. And mm-hmm. I went back and forth about this a lot, you know, and then ultimately I thought about it very simply. I was like, well, do I want his name in my book about my life? And I don't, you know, I felt like, and I also kind of feel like some things are a little bit more universal, like the person who abused me really could have been a lot of different people also. Mm-hmm. And is, you know, unfortunately there are a lot of people like that out there. And also the university that made the choices that they made with regard to, you know, the survivors of this sexual abuse and violence, that was a lot of universities doing that. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? So I kind of felt like in some ways not naming it is in some weird ways truer than naming them. Because once you name them, then you're saying, oh, well, this person did it. And everyone can go, oh, phew, it's only them. But it's not. It was really all over the place.
It also has this really impactful doubling effect. Mm-hmm. Similar, I think, to what Grayson says to Erica in the book of, you know, we got to make sure this is tying into the Title IX angle here. We want to go bigger. We want to go broader. And mm-hmm. I think every time you're not encountering the specific name of the university at the heart of this book, you are thinking about other football programs and other universities and other coaches and players. Mm-hmm. And even if you're not familiar with this part of the country or this particular football program, there's probably one you're at least adjacent to, whether it be because of your education history or where you live. And I think that opening out in the book is one of the most powerful decisions that is on the page. It's just, it's really kind of astounding what it does.
Yeah. Thank you. I've had more people than I can even believe come up to me and say, yeah, I went to this school and this thing happened in the same exact sequence of events.
Wow.
The survivors were silenced. They were kicked out of the school. You know, it's really, and just new stories all the time. And it's sort of also encouraging to know that those stories are becoming fewer and fewer as time goes on, you know? So someday this book will be a relic, and I hope it happens soon. Really, honestly, I'd love to sacrifice that book to that cause of you know, this not even being a problem anymore, but it does continue.
It was wild how at the end you talk about these other cases that you began working on after this case that became easier and easier because people were talking more. Mm. They were able to talk about it more and name names more and not have to live in fear. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you really do hope that keeps getting better and better and better, because it's devastating. It's absolutely devastating what happened.
Even, I don't know, did you see the Netflix show The Chair? Have you watched that show?
Which one's that?
It's about this like little college, and in there is a whole character who is a Title IX coordinator, and I was like, we did that, we created that. There was never that.
That's amazing.
That position didn't even exist before. Wow. You know, and now this, like, even, well, it's fictional, but like this little rinky-dinky college has a Title IX coordinator. I said, oh
yes, my husband is the director of compliance at a small university, and he also does Title IX coordination.
Right,
so thank you.
Thank him. So funny.
So how did you start making this book? How did you have, and this is related to a question I also wanted to ask you, was if you were writing during these years that you were a PI on this case, you know, did you have something that you were drawing from as you started to make the book? What did that process look like for you?
Oh, I can tell you it was hairy, because I knew I didn't want to spend 10 years on this book. I knew I would just become a nervous wreck if I mm-hmm. spent 10 years on the topic, not only of, you know, this really amazing and historic, I mean, it's the first ever Title IX sexual assault case in history, right? So I'd be thinking about this all the time. And also my own experience, I was like, I don't know if I could, I have to go hard on this. So, so what ended up happening, this is the only time this has ever happened, but we sold the book on proposal. It'll be the only time it ever happens in my life. But it was.
It sounds like something that happens to a writer in a movie, right? Like it's right. Like, and then you right. went and had, you know, like this great lunch at whatever, Gramercy Tavern, you know?
Right. Yeah. Like 30 years of my career, like it's happened once and it'll never happen again. but so that happened and I was like, okay, oh crap, you know, now I have to really do it. And then, I hit it really hard. I spent 2 full months outlining, and I know that sounds weird, but to give you perspective, my outline was 100,000 words, and I was pulling. Yeah, it was as big as the book, and I pulled all my work materials, all newspaper articles I could find, all the court documents I could find, every public source. And put them together and organize them into, and then like the rough chapters, you know, what is this chapter going to do? What, you know, who's in it and who, you know, and how to lay out the story. And I had to also like sort of compare it to the weather situations that were going on at the time. So I'm like doing the weather research, I'm doing all of it. Right. Cause we had fires at the time. It was all just like a mess. It was like, you know, the end of days.
If you believe that kind of stuff over here. That.
Yeah. Sometimes it feels like that now sometimes here. Yeah, but so that was 2 months. And then I wrote and revised it over just, and keep in mind, like my last book took 10 years. I wrote and revised it over 13 months, which is so short for me. But the way I did it was for this whole period, I worked these days that were just bananas. So I had what I called writing days and non-writing days. So on my writing days, that was Wednesday, Saturday, and Sunday. I would get up and start working at 7 a.m. and I would stop at 10 or 11 at night. And I'd take my meals at my desk. So it was like this manic, bleh, you know, vomit. And then on my writing, non-writing days, I was working, you know, I was, you know, making money. And then I would, after and between my, you know, regular work, I spent between 4 and 8 hours. Well, sometimes it was as little as 2, but usually it was 4 to 8 hours writing on the book too. So even my non-writing days, I was still logging in a lot of time, trying to get this done. So, and I never took a day off. So that was that period. and then I was finished with the revision and then sent it off to my publisher and then I kind of collapsed. So the whole process was 15 months of the most intense writing work I've ever done. Did that answer your question?
It did. And I'm just wondering how it felt knowing that it was finished and that you know, like did it feel finished?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Finished is a weird word, right?
Yeah.
Because especially with this book, it really wasn't finished after it was finished. So then it went through like the regular editorial rounds with the publisher, but we had to do also a legal read. And we did that. We actually did that at 2 junctures because the book was shut down for 7 months.
Why?
Because some people got wind of it and decided that I couldn't write it.
What?
Yeah. Oh my it was God. A pretty scary time because it was COVID. And, you know, my husband was out of work, you know, he runs an acupuncture clinic and I'm like doing all this contract work around the clock to try and like make his clinic rent and our family, you know, like, so it was just this, like, it was a really, it was a hard time. And I was like, oh, and my career's over.
Oh my God.
And that's happening. So that was really hard. I'll just be honest. Like, you know, I started having like heart problems.
Oh my like, God.
This book's going to actually kill me. and then, but you know, it got as close to resolved as it was going to. There wasn't any legal basis for the claim. It was just a tactic. So we were able to revise. So then the legal review was kind of cut up into 2. And then that was always the concern afterwards, like, oh, did we use the right word? And, you know, just revisiting all that language. So nonfiction, I mean, fiction is so beautiful in that that's not something you usually really have to worry about.
No.
Nonfiction, that is so much what you have to worry about. So it was a eye-opening experience for me. And then yeah, I never felt like it was done until I saw it between covers. And then I was like, oh my God, it actually is. That's a book.
It's a book. Oh my God.
Did the elements, some of the elements in the book that are, I think, elevated beyond, because just the core story is so unbelievable. And it seemed like I was thinking if I was taking on this project, if this had been my life experience, I would be so daunted by just the bare facts of what you were working with. Mm-hmm. But some of the elements that really make this book, I think, uniquely special are, you know, the Heidemann section, the genie section. Is mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember, is that the name of the feral?
Genie.
And some, you know, some of the other elements like that, was that stuff that emerged during that 15 months that you were writing the book, or was that stuff, Erica, that you had from your private investigator days and you had just done some, had done reading at that point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the, you know, the private eye anecdotes, they came, a lot of them came from my reading, because I was like, well, what is out there about like private eye memoir? There's not much, you know, there really just isn't. A lot of private eyes, they're people, so they don't really, they're not really writers, you know what I mean? But I was very curious. I was like, well, you know, what have other people done? And what are some other cool stories that can connect with this one and give another side to it? So I looked into, like, you know, just random thing. The Heidemann story, I think I found in a New Yorker that was from, you know, I don't know, I think it was written about in like 1930 or 20 or something like that. Wow. So I'm looking at, I was like the 30s, because I remember seeing like all these war ads. It was really interesting. Wow. But so, you know, I found things in really weird places. And the genie story was just something that always kind of stuck inside me. You know, certain stories you go through in your life, and you know, they have these barbs and they sort of like stick in you until you write about them, and then it's kind of like you're loosening them up and letting them go on the page where they belong, instead of hooked into you and guiding your movements, right? So I think that for me, I really like anecdotes anyway, and I use them a lot in fiction. So it was sort of I think it's a long-standing technique for me that I've always liked, and it's one of those things where I'm like, I don't care if it works, really, you know what I mean? Like, I like stories. I just love the little stories, and I like to just sort of connect your story to other stories and create the sort of web of stories, because that's just what I love. So I don't know, do you guys use those kind of,
not as well as you.
Well, do you have your little ticks, right? Like your little things that you're like, these are my ways, and if you don't like it, you know, screw off.
That's right.
Oh yeah, I definitely have, like, everything always has to have a smell in my writing.
Yeah.
Like a very specific smell, and sometimes it's gross, and I think you know, if I'm looking at my Goodreads reviews, people are like, God, you know, please, but I can't help it. That's just who I am.
But right. Yeah.
In addition to those anecdotes that Alex brought up and that you love, your use of metaphor throughout the book is so delightful and beautiful, that you'll just be describing a naked mole rat, mm-hmm. After you're describing your childhood, mm-hmm. or you're describing the Chinooks. You know, you talked a lot about the weather, and you're telling us about this because you're telling us about the place, or you're telling us about something about you, but it does so much, and it is so enriching and beautiful, just so beautiful. And I just wanted to know, like, those metaphors, those moments, as you were writing, did they come naturally? Like, was it sort of like, ah, yes, and this reminds me of the naked mole rat that I love, you know, or ah, yes, right. Let me talk about the Chinooks here.
Right.
You know,
right.
Similar to the anecdotes, like, is that something that as you wrote, it was sort of just came over you? Like,
I think, you know, I don't, you know, certain minds are warped in certain ways. Right. And my head is, and I think actually a lot of writers, I don't know if this is true for you guys when you write, but like, I think, for me, it's sort of like this, I think of things in connection. I have to, you know what I mean? Or I don't understand them. I can't understand anything all by itself, even like a glass of water, really doesn't make a lot of sense to me all by itself. And you know, that might be partly because, like, you know, my brain was broken at a really young age, but also I just need to sort of create the web, right? So for me, when I'm writing, I'm always trying to find the example of the exterior example, because I don't have confidence in my interior thoughts and experiences, really. You know, it's really, I think it probably comes from not having a very clearly or well-defined feeling of self, you know what I mean? So if I can connect it to this thing in nature, or this thing in, you know, the animal world, or this story of a PI, or this story of another person that I interacted with, then it makes it real. But if it's all by myself and just my experience, I'm going to have a lot of trouble with believing my own experience to be either important enough to write about, or even making any sense. Because what, you know, again, like the experiences I went through, just like the ludicrous experiences in the case that I worked on, and they're really hard to believe, you know what I mean? So if someone had told me, oh yeah, you know, I went through, you know, this person went through this thing, I'd be like, no, I didn't really, you know what I mean? It's just so weird. So, or just not weird, weird's the wrong word. It's just, it's hard to believe, right? So for me, I kind of felt like with the narrative of the case, and also with my personal narrative, I had to sort of create a web of stories to give it scaffolding, and that's part of that, like, truth is stranger than fiction idea. But even, you know, you have to, with fiction, right, you have to create that suspension, willing suspension of disbelief, right? I think in some ways you really still have to do that with nonfiction too. And with nonfiction, things are harder to the touch. It's really hard for a reader to say, oh my gosh, that is true and that happened, and I'm going to keep reading rather than run screaming into the night, right? So you have to sort of create this, almost like this, you have to surround them with reasons to keep going with your story. Anyway, that's how I felt. I don't know if it's true for other people. I don't know. Do you guys ever feel that way, or like you got to keep them on the page?
Absolutely.
Don't go away.
Totally. Yeah. And I think it's those surprising pivots that's what I look for when I'm reading. And that's what makes it so memorable for me. And I was reading Patrick Hoffman's review of the book in the New York Times, which I have to say, like, my husband was Googling this book and he was like, oh my God, Patrick Hoffman wrote the review. He loves his books.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He was like, oh my God, that's amazing. Anyway,
so funny.
He was saying, you know, readers of traditional true crime will, you know, be annoyed by these, you know, these things that she talks about, the weather and the this and the that. Right. And I wanted to know if it felt strange to you, that this book was being sort of, you know, marketed in some way as true crime, because that is a very rigid audience, right? Like, that audience has expectations.
Yes.
And they will let those expectations be known. Was it strange to sort of know that, oh, I'm going to be dipping my toe here?
Yeah. The marketing piece, that's the thing, is like, you know, the bookstores have their sections and you need to say where your book goes, right? And I was like, I don't know if there's a section for me. And I've always kind of felt, I don't know if you've ever felt this way, you guys, but like, I don't know if, you know, when you really write from, and I know this sounds cheesy, but you write from the heart, right? Like, when you really do that, where's your section? You know, like, what's your category? Really, you're trying to not have one. You're trying to do something new. You're trying to do something you haven't seen before a million zillion times, right? You're trying to sort of play with structure and play with genre and play with just the whole idea of story to make your own personal brand of story, right? So as far as that's concerned, I do know there are really rigid expectations with true crime. I mean, I just the other day I interviewed for Tattered Cover Paul Holes, who's like, you know, true crime, you know, like a Golden State Killer's finder, right?
Oh, yeah,
and the I was just filled with people who had like sweatshirts and like this whole, and they
like a whole like thing going.
Okay. Yeah. Like empire. Right. So, yeah. And they knew just as much of, you know, they knew so much about his cases. So they're like asking all these questions, like, what about the town hall meeting? And what about, you know, like all this stuff that's not even in the book. And I'm like, oh my gosh. So, it, you know, so again, and there's a difference between what I was doing and that. So it's a little confusing. And I do wonder if, you know, if it's true that like, if someone is really into true crime and they pick up the book, they'll be like, well, this is, this is a bummer. But I have to hope that, you know, a good story is a good story. And I tried to write a good story, and I tried to, again, do that new thing. And so I don't know how I feel about the marketing. You know, I don't know. How do you guys feel about, like, you know, how do you feel about genre? I'm kind of curious, like, do you think books should have genres, or should it just be like good book, medium book, bad book?
In
the
store. In our future bookstore, that's how we write the books on the shelves. Like, don't even look at these over here.
Right. Or these, like, want to laugh. You want to laugh, you go over here. You want to cry, you go over here. You want to be angry, you go over here.
Well, reading for this show is kind of interesting in that way, because, you know, we're doing pretty much an episode a week, and sometimes getting through the books, and sometimes it's a joy, but sometimes it's less a joy. That's okay. Everybody's great.
Alex, what are you doing?
But, you know, I come to the books pretty, you know, just blank. I don't read the reviews. I don't Google the author. I kind of just pick it up and go. And I honestly, because I actually have not read any reviews of the book, Erica, until Lindsay said it, I did not even think of this as true crime, as crazy as that is.
Totally.
It's a very, structurally, I feel like this is like a very novelistic memoir. The way that you pull in so many different things, and just characterization feels novelistic to me in the best way. It doesn't feel, I don't know, not that I think necessarily true crime is, you know, would hamper that understanding. I don't know.
It really feels like there needs to be a new category, because like my favorite quote true crime books are like this. I loved this, and I loved The Fact of the Body, Down City, After the Eclipse. I love books that blend. One of my favorites is Strange Piece of Paradise, which is written by a woman who was attacked in her tent with her friend, and then it's her investigation into trying to figure out who did that to them. And it's this blend of the personal and also the universal, rather than let's talk about this serial killer, which I'm also like, I've also read those books, but these are my favorite kinds. And it really isn't, true crime is not the phrase, but what is it? You know, like, and I know
they're searching books. There's so much. I was thinking of this. I mean, you just mentioned serial, but I was thinking of, in Zodiac, the feeling you get watching the movie Zodiac.
I love
that's
Zodiac.
My favorite movie.
Oh my god, just I love that one.
I watch that the way some people watch You've Got Mail. Like, I watch it as a comfort.
Yes, it's, yes, so it's absolutely wonderful. Yes,
but just that you get so invested in the search, and there's so much hope in that search, and there's so much love for people in that search and obsession, even if it wrecks you. And I feel like there's definitely some of that here, and that just, you know, I don't know, use the phrase earlier, you know, these stories that get their barbs in you. And I feel like a lot of these great, you know, novelistic memoirs or searching books, they're about people who have barbs in them and are trying to get them out. And
I don't really like, excellent. But it's also like a lot of, I don't know if you find this to be true with a lot of memoirs, but like a lot of them are kind of plotless. Have you noticed this? Like they're about a condition. They're about like, okay, well, this person has this situation, but the plot doesn't really evolve, right? It's almost like, you know, I had this problem, and you know, I had a lot of feelings about it, and then now I don't have those feelings anymore. You know what I mean? Like, so for me, again, I didn't want to be under memoir either, because I was like, it's not really a memoir. It's right. like a story of a case, right? It's a story of this investigation that yes. was, and it's mostly not about me. It's mostly, so to even call it a memoir is feels wrong too.
Right.
I don't know. I think maybe if you're doing something that you don't have no idea what you're doing, maybe that's the right way to go. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like maybe mm-hmm. maybe then you're doing something right as a writer, because then you're on untrodden ground. But if you're doing the thing where you're like, oh, well, this is definitely, you know, this kind of literature is going to fit into this marketplace and et cetera. Well, then why even do it? Because then there are plenty of other books out there who are doing it, right? Just read them.
I love how you've just murdered so many writers in like the past 45 seconds. Like whole swaths of memoir writers, whole swaths of people who want to write books. You're just like, forget it.
I'm going to get hate mail. No, they should still write it, but just make it theirs. You know what I mean? Just do their own. And there are a lot. I mean, my favorite book is actually a memoir. You know what I mean? So I'm not meaning to sound like I don't like memoirs, but like, I mean, you know, my favorite book is, one of my very, very favorite books is West with the Night by Beryl Markham, you know, and that's a memoir.
Oh, come on. I forgot about that book. How could I have forgotten?
It's amazing.
And I haven't read it since college.
Yes, it's amazing. And, you know, but it's like a memoir, but it's also like, it's not about her sitting there, you know, having feelings, and we're watching her have feelings. It's her doing stuff. You know, right. she's like,
and having feelings.
And having feelings, right? But interesting feelings that are different from other feelings that you've ever heard of. So I think for, you know, so for me, like, that's the kind of memoir I like, is where they're heavily plotted. And, you know, Alex, you were talking about it, you know, the novel aspect. And I think that was, for me, the only way I was ever going to write a memoir is just if it had a plot like a novel like plot. And that's why I never thought I would write a memoir until I really hit on, I was like, wait a second, this 5-year period of my life, it has that arc. It has the novelistic arc, and I can see the whole shape of it. And I also didn't have to make anything up, which was kind of nice. You know, I was like, it's all right there. There are parts where I was like, you know, if I were writing a novel and were able to change things, I would sort of change this structurally just to make it a little bit more, you know, make it fit that arc a little bit more, because you are hampered by that nonfiction aspect. You really aren't allowed to make up your life. You have to really say what happened. But other than that, you know, if I were to write anything else about my life, it just doesn't fit that shape. I mean,
at the end of the book, you mentioned that you had to play with the timeline a little bit to make it fit better into the plot.
Right.
And was that clear to you in the outlining, or was that clear to you later as you were writing it out, or you know,
that was
making it into
clear
a book.
right away
because, okay,
yeah, I mean, there all those things happen in that time period around or a year, you know. The things that I messed around with a little bit were was my own timeline, right? But it was still that same that same period, right? It was just, you know, did this happen before that? No, it actually happened after, you know, in my personal life, right? But no one cares, right? They don't care if, like, I lived in this place at this time or that time, or if I, you know,
we did hire a PI to follow you.
Oh, wow. That's a very boring job.
Jesus, so aggressive, Lindsay. Jesus Christ.
It's just standard for every guest.
I just have to pity that PI, because they're really bored all day long.
No, but I do think people are interested, you know, like people who are thinking about writing something nonfiction. I do think people are sort of, they come up to these issues maybe and aren't sure how to proceed, or, you know, and so it's interesting to hear the choices that you made, even though they were small, you know, and in the long run, it didn't really matter, but it's a way of like taking control of, even though it's nonfiction, taking control of its, you know, its overarching structure, I guess.
Right. I, you know, I teach and at Lighthouse Writers Workshop, and I teach at a 2-year program. It's a book writing program. Mm-hmm. So I am always getting on people about structure. I'm always saying, you know, you have to know where this is going. You have to know, you know, where's your climax? Where's your, you know, all these kinds of things. I'm constantly nagging and bothering them about structure. So it's kind of fun to turn that on myself with a true story. You know what I mean? Because yeah. It's almost like there are these immovable structures that I couldn't mess with, such as like, you know, the case, really, the case mm-hmm. and the case and the weather. Those are the two things that anyone, you know, anyone could just easily find out if I messed with those timelines, right? So I kind of had to work around those things almost like they were big, like, trees in the middle of my, like, construction project, you know, like, you know, you're not going to chop down the tree, so you have to, like, you know, design around the tree. So that was a unique challenge, because I was really used to fiction and just, you know, you just change things and you just make right. stuff up and you, oh, well, this character's gone and this, you know, this is now two, this character's now three people, or it's, you know, these three are one, and you can't really, with something that has such a record, it's so public. There's so many articles about this. It was everywhere. It was on ESPN. It was like, you know, Sports Illustrated and all the local news, of course, and New York Times, Washington Post. So there's so much about this case. It was in Doonesbury. So, like, you know,
that was crazy.
I know. It's in Doonesbury. So, like, if you, you know, if you're doing something that public, you're really accountable. And just like in fiction, you know how you'll be reading fiction and someone does something that's so inconceivable in life. Like, they go to a bar and they say, "Hey, bartender, give me a beer." No, you know what I mean? Like, no one does that, right? Like, what beer? You know, what IPA or what? You know, so that something that simple will make the whole novel crumble. You know what I mean? Right. Something that implausible. We'll try doing that with an actual real life case that has a paper trail. One little error and the whole thing can crumble. And if the whole thing crumbles, not only are they doubting the book, but they could doubt even the whole premise of the book, which are these mm-hmm. sexual assaults. And I didn't want that. I didn't want people to say, "Oh, well, you know, someone ordered a beer, and so these people were not sexually assaulted." You know, like, you know, I didn't want it to go to that kind of ugly place. You know, so there, I felt a lot of pressure to get things get it right and be as true as I can to the real story.
Yeah, it reminds me, Lacey Crawford's blurb says that mm-hmm. it's told with incredible psychological insight and broad ethical attention. And it's mm-hmm. exactly what you're talking about here.
Oh, everything was a worry, you know. I didn't sleep really for the whole time. Oh, I would literally wake up in the middle of the night and say, "Wait a second, did I make that person a blonde or brunette?" You know, because I didn't want to out anyone and I didn't want to, you know, create or sometimes I changed people. I would disguise them so much that I actually disguised them back to what they really looked like. And I'd be like, "Wait a second. No, I can't. I got to change it."
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
There's an aside in the book, Erica, I think about halfway through, where the Erica in the book is mentioning that the job is getting to her in the way that she's starting to kind of, interrogate her friends, people close to her, and conversations are becoming more charged, pushing people away, whatever. Mm-hmm. That kind of attention and I don't know, increased perception, obviously it was something that you already had and why you were hired by Grayson, but did that impact how you created characters following doing that work in your fiction?
What do you mean? Like the,
well, just if bringing kind of the skill set that you naturally had, you know, the face you already had that was causing people to tell you so much about themselves, but kind of ramping up the intensity and using that professionally, you know, working on this case and other cases, mm-hmm. did that impact the way you went back to your fiction and created people from whole cloth?
I think so. And I think part of it was, I mean, you're writers, you know that you look at people differently and talk to them differently. Right. You know, there's a little bit of greed in it. Isn't there, like, you know, someone's got a story or something that they, they've experienced, or you're picking up on their mannerisms, you're picking up on their patterns of speech, their voice, their way, right? Their psychology, their value systems, the way they view the world. So you can understand them, and you're cross-referencing with other characters that you're thinking, you know, other people you're thinking about. I think it's hard to turn it off, frankly. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to, it was hard for me as when I'm writing this book, to recognize quote unquote material in a different way. So like as a fiction writer, right, you'll write about, something someone told you, and, you stop thinking of it as real. You start thinking of it as yours. And, with this, I realized, oh my God, it's nonfiction. So I can't just take this story, plop it in there and not change it because, to disguise somebody because, you know, in that alchemy with fiction, you say, oh, well, it's fiction. Everyone's going to just think it's fiction. So you can just use stuff. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So there was this one detail a friend had given me about her life. And, and she was sort of opening up and she told me something extremely personal and I had it on the first page. And then I realized pretty late in the game, I was like, wait a second. She might not like that, you know, especially because it's nonfiction. If it were a short story, I don't think she'd care. But I was like, wait a second. So I contacted her. I said, hey, I kind of put that thing you told me in my book, how do you feel about that? And she's like, take it out. So I did, you know, of course I did, right? Immediately, right? I was like, stop the process. I mean, it wasn't that late, but it was sort of like that because I was just, like, there's just a different meaning to everything. And I have been doing that, honestly, since I was 19, maybe, you know, I've been, you know, talking to people and then, you know, often changing what they say, but sometimes not. Sometimes they just put their stories in there because there's also that feeling of like, who's going to read it anyway? Nobody reads, right?
Nobody fucking reads. Who cares?
It's true. I sometimes I'm like, oh my God, my family's going to see this and they're going to recognize it. And they never do. Right. Never. Right. It's just wild.
You change the hair color maybe, or, you know, or people don't necessarily even recognize themselves.
They don't recognize themselves. They really don't.
Yeah.
They can't recognize what they don't read.
That's true. Yep. It works for all of us, honestly.
That's true. Yeah, definitely.
did anything surprise you about how you feel having this book out?
Yeah, a lot surprised me. I was just really ready to fight people about it. I was really, you know, I was like, okay, it's, you know, people are going to hate me and that's going to be okay. And I'm going to be okay with that. You know, even though I have this like pathological need to make people like me, I'm just like, I'm just going to be okay with being hated. And so I was really ready for all kinds of viciousness that hasn't, I mean, there've been a few people, but what I wasn't prepared for is how embracing and loving a lot of people have been. People have emailed me and said, you know, this is my story too, or this affected me and here's why. Sometimes I, you know, on a few dates I've opened my email and then like read a message or two and I'm just weeping because people are, you know, they're telling me that, that the book helped them. And that is amazing. That's an amazing feeling because I don't know, as a fiction writer, that doesn't often happen, right? Mm-hmm. At least not my fiction, maybe you guys, but not me. Nope. So Alex is like, nope. Right? You know, so, you know, fiction is a different response, right? But with nonfiction, you actually have, you have that opportunity to, by telling your story, to make other people feel like they can tell theirs. And a lot of the people who need to tell those stories have been so silenced their whole lives that it's there's a different level of disclosure that's coming, with regard to this book as opposed to any story I've ever written, any book I've ever written or anything. So that surprised me. It's surprised me how emotional I've felt. because, you know, I'm a rhinoceros by this point. It's been like 30, you know, over 35 years, something, It's been a long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm 28, so it's only been
yeah.
Just kidding.
What are you talking about?
I know. It's been like yesterday. I've been writing a year. No, just kidding. No, so, you know, as a woman of a certain age, it's been a longer career. And by now I've got a lot of calluses, but I'm finding what's surprising me is that this experience is sort of definitely softening some of those calluses. And I'm finding myself very more connected to readers than I've ever felt before. Mm. And that's been, I don't know if you can hear it in my voice, but I'm, you know, that makes me feel very emotional mm-hmm. and weepy. And it makes me feel more connected to the world. So that, just as a writer, usually, you know, you're off in your little corner making your stuff up and again, like, you know, there's a lot of isolation to it, but this has been a very connective experience. And that's been a huge surprise.
It's beautiful because I feel like that's why a lot of us read, is to find mm-hmm. ourselves somehow, is to find something yeah. to connect or show us ourselves. And you wrote something that did that for you.
Right. I know. What a beautiful, weird experience. Amazing, right?
Yeah.
I kind of always feel like, you know, we're very siloed and isolated in communities. And a book is kind of like the hub of a wheel. Like mm-hmm. you know, you're over here and someone's over there and you would never connect, but through this book you sort of do, you know, mm-hmm. like even if you don't know it, even if you don't know that someone over in Topeka read this book and you read that book too, and you both had the same kind of experience, but you might meet that person from Topeka. Right. And then right. you might say, oh my God, I read, you know, Lindsay Hunter's book. And it's like, it was the most yeah. amazing experience people of my life. And it's changed me. And like, it, you know, I now see the world differently. And they'll say, yes, I did. Me too. Right. So it's this thing that can bring people together in a way that really nothing else can. No other artwork can.
Way that I can like meaningfully communicate with a certain person in my family at this point in my life. Right. I just mail her books, like on birthdays and stuff
oh.
and Christmas, you know,
yeah.
And she reads them, and it's like a way for us to like, it's the only way that we can actually right. sort of meaningful connection at this point.
Right. Sometimes it's like you're so different politically, or you're so yeah. different, you know, mm-hmm. with your value system, or, you know, the things that you believe. But then you find this book that you both can love, and you can, and there's this, and suddenly there's a way for you to love each other.
Right. Exactly.
Through like,
I'm not giving up on you.
Right. Right. And not only that, but you're investing in, right. in each other.
Right.
It's really meaningful when a family member or somebody will read the books that you want them to read. Right?
It's rare. Honestly, it's rare.
It is.
So yeah. it is. I'm very touched that she does read them. So.
Right.
Yeah. yeah. Books, man. You know, like books.
It's all about books. Right. Right. It's all about the books. Books, man. I mean, I don't know about you guys. I don't know how you decided to be writers, but I never wanted to be a writer. I just said, I want to write books. That was mm-hmm. for me the thing. Wow. Like, I want to make books. Mm-hmm. And that was being a writer sounded like a miserable life. And I was like, but making books, you know, if you write books, then you're creating these things that you love. So that for me is the most, that's a priority for me.
Definitely. Yeah. I think it was like about like manipulating people for me.
Tell me more about that.
In the beginning, I'm thinking way back, like, I was just thinking about this recently, that like I won a writing contest in like fourth grade. I think I was just talking about this. Wasn't I, Alex? Did I bring this up on the podcast?
Oh, God, no idea.
Okay. So it was a memorable story.
Well, we've done a few.
I remember they were like, okay, so what you have to do is write a fiction story. Mm-hmm. And whoever wins gets to meet Robert Newton Peck. And Okay. I went home, and this is what I thought to myself. I thought, I know what people want. I'll just give them what they want. And I wrote a story, and I won the contest. And I was like, God. See, I knew it.
Oh my God, really?
Yes. And, amazing. You know, and I always was like a huge reader. I was always reading, constantly reading. And I think, you know, from such shitty beginnings on my part, it turned into something that really became part of me, and you know, a way that I could like communicate, you know, But
so what
yeah.
do people want? What is it? What mm-hmm. do people want? What do they want, that's Lindsay? That's what I want to know. Listen, what did you write?
They want everything to have a smell. Okay. So
yeah, that's right. Yeah. Smell.
Yeah. I think I did a lot of sensory stuff. Yeah. Like I did a lot of like, you know, here's what the weather was like and here's what he was thinking. You know, I was just like, I just have to really describe like in the moment, man. I don't know why I thought like that. I was just like, I know what people want and I can do it.
That's it. Kind of amazing, actually. You should probably be a PI too.
It was all downhill from there.
Well, it's kind of amazing that you knew what people wanted and you were able to deliver it. But then again, like there are a lot of people doing sensory writing out there and they're not winning the contest. You know what I mean?
That's right. Okay. I smelled Robert Newton Peck's whiskey breath and nobody else did. Okay.
That's kind of interesting. I don't give people what they want. I think I give them something they don't want and try and make them want it. Yeah,
I definitely don't. Yeah. I don't know if you've read this one yet, but I'm just going to give you this recommendation, which Coffee House put out a book recently called When Women Kill.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I want to read that.
It's a book in translation by a Chilean author that we're actually having on the show.
Oh, cool.
Her name is Aliyah Tribuco Zoran, and she goes back and investigates four historical killings, Chilean killings.
Oh my gosh, I want to read that.
By women, and she kind of like re-injects them with her modern understanding and her you know historical perspective, and the book is fucking wild. It is unbelievable.
I will check that out. Is that Coffee House Press?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Coffee House, yeah. But I agree with you. There's so many weirdo books that slip through the cracks.
I love the weirdo books. I was thinking about it recently. I was like, would Catch 22 be published today with
absolutely
a big
not.
Never.
No,
my
God. No never. Way.
And that's my favorite. That's one of my very favorite books. Wow.
There's so many examples like that too, Erica. I think where you could name whatever it may be. You know, I think of even something like oh my God. I'm blanking on the name of my favorite book. I literally
Been there. So long, see you tomorrow.
Yeah.
Winesburg, Ohio.
Yeah. No. So long. See you tomorrow.
Right. Okay. Like, right. Yes.
That there's no way at that page count that it would be published the way it was, you know, and serialized in the New Yorker. There's just absolutely no way. And that book is, I don't know, a masterpiece. It's like, there's so many like that.
Oh, Great Gatsby would never be published today.
Right. Exactly.
Catcher in the Rye would never be published today.
I mean, like, it's crazy.
Like, they'd say, oh, it's too slow, or the action's off screen, or whatever they say. You know what I mean? It's just it's amazing.
The action's
like,
off screen. Oh, my God. It hurts. You know, it hurts.
I want to know about you guys and your processes, because you, like, I was doing the nice podcast thing and everything, but I want to know about you guys. Like, what are your processes?
Oh, boy.
Alex, you go.
I hate you. you know, Erica, I've written so little in the past 2 years. I was revising a book, and we were on submission for a long time. And that was, I was like surprisingly taxed by that. And I was embarrassed by how taxed I was by it, because.
And Alex has very young daughters. Very young.
Oh, how old?
Yeah. It's almost 2 and almost 4.
Oh God.
And I was working kind of a crazy, I'm working kind of a crazy schedule, and we're doing this show, and the show is really a lifeline just to be able to talk to a buddy and kind of stay in the world of books, I think, because I was so burned out on the project that I was working on for so long. And I haven't written a lot. Mm-hmm. I have a start of something that I'm excited about, but I don't know. I'm kind of all or nothing with most things. And so right now I'm more all in on watching playoff hockey than I am on, like, you know, working on the novel, but it'll be there. I do have enough where I know that I'm excited and I'm going to return to it, but
I think you need the breaks though. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's, I can't keep going. It, like,
oh yeah.
For me, it's like binge and purge kind of.
Yes.
And, you know, mm-hmm. although you're not allowed to say that because it's triggering, but you know, but it is like some people are like, they are like soldiers and they march on and every day, you know, but they don't write, they'll write like what, like an hour, you know what I mean? Every day, you know, and I'm like, I just rather, you know, ruin my life for a few years.
Yes.
And then And then
I relate to
then,
that.
Yeah. And then sort of take a break and yeah. and then do the other crap I have to do and then ruin it again.
I love that. I'm gonna steal that. I'd rather ruin my life for a few years.
Yeah. Well, you know,
it's like, a great line.
I don't know about you guys, but I sometimes feel like you know, it shortens your life. I feel like it shortens my, you know,
for real. Yes.
But it's worth it. I don't know. Yes. How about you, Lindsay? What's your process like when you?
I had a novel out on submission right when the pandemic started.
Oh God.
And so that was a nightmare. Oh, and God. It went through, my editor at FSG had the option and she wanted to buy it, but her boss passed. So that happened. And then, we went back out, some months after that. And there was excitement from a bunch of editors like, oh yes, I can't wait to read Lindsay's book. And then ultimately they all said no. And then I got some feedback on how I could make it have more of a plot, speaking of plot. So I rewrote it. Mm-hmm. Oh, and in the meantime, while it was on submission, I wrote this other book.
Amazing. Really?
I was just going to say
a whole other book.
I don't know what got into me. I honestly don't.
You were
I think
on
it was
fire. You were just like going.
Yeah. Cause like the novel that was out on submission, I wrote, you know, in the 18 months before that. Mm-hmm. And then I had this new idea for this other novel. So I just wrote that. I just worked on it like every day.
How long did you work? I mean, how long was it on submission?
That process ended up being like a year to 15 months of like we sent it to my original editor.
Oh my God.
And then like yeah. months passed where like, you know,
but how'd you write the book in 15 months? Really? I mean, I did like kill myself to do that. Like how'd
you
do that?
I honestly don't know. I don't know how I did it. I just, it was like one of those times in my life where I knew what I was going to write. Like I just sat down and I just wrote it. And that kind of happened to me with my last novel, Eat Only When You're Hungry. Mm. And so I was like, I knew that I was just on something. I don't know. And then I rewrote the original novel and in the hopes that we could send it out again with more of a plot with the same characters and sort of the same themes. Mm-hmm. And then while that was happening, my friend Roxanne Gay contacted me and said, do you have any books that aren't published? And I said, yeah, here's the situation. I have this book that I've now rewritten. And mm-hmm. I also have this other weird book. It's like super weird. It's my murder book. And she took the murder book. And so
she did.
She took that. So that's coming out next year.
But what's it called?
It's called Hot Springs Drive. I think I'm in this process right now where I'm like, nothing actually means anything but family, like my children. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And I think that's because I need a break.
Yeah.
God, so that's where I'm at right
going,
now.
You were going though. You were going like, and Lindsay edits this podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
and my child isn't napping anymore. I don't know. Yeah, I've lost my mind.
But you have three. Oh my God.
Three. Yeah. Three is the next level.
Yeah. Well, so I'm at the point where I'm like, fuck everything. I just want to run through the grass with my kids.
Yes.
Oh.
But I will come, you know, like eventually I remember reading a Marcy Dermansky essay and she was like, one day your children go to school and then you're like, oh yeah, I'm a writer. So I look forward to that in the fall when my daughter goes to preschool.
Right. Oh my God. So Lindsay, I just still really can't understand how you wrote a novel in 15 months with three kids. Because I thought I was going to go into organ failure when I was writing mine. You know what I mean? Like, I thought it was going to die. I actually thought I was like, I'm going to either finish this or it's going to finish me. And you just did it.
Yeah. And I didn't have to have the added like emotional weight that you were carrying as you wrote it. You know, like mine was fiction. It was actually based on a true crime. It's based on a true crime. So like
the title sounds
my
like
lifetime of research into true crime is coming to fruition here. But no, I think I it was a really bad year, you know, plus of like dealing with the pandemic and being scared. And it was like a way for me to like, it was just necessary. I worked on it like, cause at that time I was able to swing like hours a day because
you're writing in the car. That was the big thing.
Oh my
right?
God. I would write in the car.
That was the big one.
Like you're dropping people off or something like
yes.
that?
Yes. And I would sit in the parking lot and write. I would write on That's the awesome. Toilet. Okay. Like I was just like a crazy fiend.
Mommy's in the bathroom.
Yes. Exactly.
Door is locked.
My dog was sick. And so she would get up really early in the morning to pee. And I would go downstairs with her, let her out. And then I would sit and write until my kids woke up. And I was just getting, and it was like, of course I'm doing this. Of course. And now I look at that and I'm like, what the hell was I doing? Like I was just on another level. I think that just happens sometimes, you know, like you just, but I don't know, maybe it sucks.
And then afterward, you know, you both write the way I write. So like afterward, don't you feel like you have no idea how you did it and it'll never happen again. You'll never be able to do it again. Like sometimes I'll finish this big burst. Right. And then I'm like, Well, I guess I'm done now. I can't.
That's it.
You know what I mean? Like, do you ever have that feeling?
Over.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Like, I have no idea how to do it again.
When my book wouldn't sell, I was like, well, this is it for me. I was like, it's a good run.
been there, honey. Like, last book.
Know, yeah. Right.
Same thing. And I was like, well, that's it. I guess,
that's
you
it.
Know.
Roll credits.
I really, you know, you have the imposter syndrome and you're like, well, I guess I really am that imposter.
Yes,
like,
totally. And I would tell myself things like, well, one day I'll be gardening and I'll be like a 65-year-old lady with a big old sun hat and someone will wander up the lane, whatever lane I'm going to be living on. I don't know. And they're going to be like, are you Lindsay Hunter? I loved your book from, you know, 40 years ago or whatever, 30 years ago. And I'm like, and that'll be nice. Maybe one day someone will be like, remember Lindsay Hunter? Isn't that so narcissistic?
No, actually, you know what? Do you guys know the writer Lucia Berlin?
Oh yeah. Yeah,
that's she's my teacher. So she
what?
Oh
yeah,
wow.
She's my teacher at CU, and I'll be like, we all thought she was brilliant, and we were like little Luciaites, but like, you know, during her lifetime, she maybe sold total 200 books, right? Like,
God, is that true?
Yeah. Wow. Nobody was reading her. She was with this tiny, tiny press called Black Sparrow Press.
Oh, yeah. Black Sparrow. Yeah.
Yeah. And she went with them because they weren't going to mess with her, that they weren't going to suggest any edits. And that's who she wanted. And then nobody was reading her. Nobody, except for like us, like crazy people. And then like she, again, not allowed to say crazy, bananas people, sugar people. So she's, you know, and then all of a sudden she, you know, what, 12 years after her death or something like that? Like, you know, her friend collects her work and throws it for a Strauss and they're like, and they publish her. And then she's like a, you know, sensation.
Major. Yeah. It was like a bestseller. That, it was that, huge.
The collected or whatever, the orange cover with the key is like ubiquitous. I mean, like it's, I mean.
Yeah. But like her whole life, no one's reading her whole
That's
life. So there's hope. Right, there's always hope.
When I'm dead,
God, there's that.
I don't care anymore.
Just die. You just have to die.
There's that that washing machine story.
Like oh with the, yeah. The,
oh my God! Like I returned to that. Washamat. Yes, exactly.
Yes.
She's I can't. Like it's crazy that she wasn't read. What a fucking genius.
Well, jeez. That story actually was in the Atlantic, and she said I have this like video of her like talking about her work, but she said that. Atlantic was they were the only place that would publish it that as it was in the because the first line would never be published today was I don't know why Indians get so drunk.
Oh right.
But you know she wasn't racist, it was like you know, the character the character being like that, but like today and the no character's way. Not like racist, the character's like rejecting, you know what I mean? So it's like it's not even that, but like it just today would never happen. And some of her stuff I'm like, oh Lucia, like it would not fly to, you know, but again, it's the character. It's not her, you know. It's just you can't even write that way anymore, you know.
Thank you so much, Erica, for coming on. We absolutely love your book.
Loved it.
So excited for everyone to read it and hit us up and talk to us about it because it's incredible.
You have to read this book.
Oh, thank you guys. It's been so incredible talking to you both, and I'm so excited to just be on your show. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Erica.
was awesome.
That was awesome.
She's great.
That book is so incredible. It has everything. It has everything it has I could everything. Ever want in a book.
It's one of my favorite books we read for the show. I absolutely loved it.
But also just be aware, anyone reading it, you're going to be so enraged.
Disgusted. Absolutely disgusted. Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's horrific. And
you're ready to be mad.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were at least three times, and this isn't something that happens a ton to me reading. There were at least three times where I had to set the book down and take a breather. It was, yeah.
It's just crazy. but that's it. I got nothing.
That's it. Yeah, nothing either, bud.
I started to read Swan Huntley's book. She's coming on.
Oh, nice.
Oh, we're going to talk to Christian Collier this week.
Oh, yeah. Christian Collier. Yeah.
So good stuff. All good stuff.
Perfect. All right. Well, see you on Tuesday or Wednesday or something.
Yeah. Bye.
All right, buddy. Bye.
I'm a Writer But is recorded by Alex Higley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop.